Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me out, be the biggest little flirt. Well, I might have.
Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hey, welcome to the Shame-Free Zone. It's 2012. We're all still here. That's good. Okay, I know the year just started. Who knows what's coming? But while we're all still here, I want to welcome you to tonight's show. We're actually going to be talking about what I think is a very timely topic. It's January. A lot of couples may have actually skirted flirted with the idea of divorce. Believe it or not, the rates of divorce and domestic violence go up this time of year, so it's a pretty problematic time of year for couples. And my guest tonight is going to be talking to us about finances in the context of marriage, relationships. I think we're also going to be talking about living together. So whether you're married or not, if you're sharing finances with a romantic partner, this show is going to be the one you want to listen to. And January, of course, is a time when a lot of people have overextended themselves for the holidays. And it's also a time when we kind of take stock of what we did the year before. So this would be a good show to listen into. Take notes. We're actually going to be having a giveaway, as a matter of fact. But without further ado, let me introduce my guest. Her name is Dr. Taffy Wagner. She's a certified educator in personal finances, money, and marriage advocate. She's also an ordained minister and a veteran for the U.S. Armed Forces. She's authored a few books. There's one called Bride and Groom Money, Talk FAQ, Debt Dilemma, Homebuyer's Helper, How to Have and Hold On to Your House. Boy, that sounds like a timely topic as well. And she's been interviewed by a lot of folks, including Wall Street Journal, the Denver Business Journal, Bob Brinker Money Talk, AOL Black Voices, the Associated Press, U.S. News and World Report, Called Magazine, and Woman's Day. And she also is a financial columnist for blackbride.com and adviceandinfo.com. Dr. Wagner, welcome to the Shame Free Zone.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thrilled to have you here. Now, before we get started, tell our listeners a little bit about the giveaway so maybe they'll be inspired to call in. And after you tell them about the giveaway, I'll make sure they get that number.
That sounds great. What I want to give away tonight is one 30-minute, no-cost counseling session regarding finances. So the first person that calls in and asks a question, and it can be about finances, they will actually win a 30-minute session with me at a later time. But we want them to be involved with us and get their questions answered, no longer have shame about money.
Right, exactly. I just thought it was so funny. You know, usually in the Shame-Free Zone, I'm talking about sexual issues. Tonight, we're going to be talking about money. I could see talking about money a lot because it's up for a lot of people, for most of us, in fact. And I think it is something that has more taboo and more shame attached to it than sex.
It does. And I, as a person who was in debt myself, I had a lot of shame. I didn't want anybody to know that I was suffering, that I was struggling. And while I was having all that shame and pride, I couldn't get help.
Absolutely. Well, for the listeners, if you want to get this 30-minute, no-cost counseling session with Dr. Wagner, call us toll-free. Our United States toll-free number is 888-627-6008. Once again, that's 888-627-6008. 6008, and that's also good in Canada. If for some reason you're not able to access a toll-free number, you can call us direct at 530-327-7602 or 530-413-5011. That's 530-413-5011. So, Dr. Wagner, Tell us a little bit about how your doctorate of ministry in biblical counseling helps people with money.
Because my background in itself is all about the finances, because I'm the person that was struggling, didn't know how to manage money, wouldn't talk to anybody about my own financial situation, and I ended up homeless for a period of time based on not being able to say to anybody, I need some help. Can somebody tell me what I'm doing wrong? Help me, you know, balance out my books and get my finances in order. So what I find happens is people always talk to me about whatever's going on in their life. And so I don't even tell them that I'm an ordained minister, and they know I have a doctorate, but they don't usually know what it's in. And I end up getting all this information about how they've struggled with whether it was finances in the church or it's finances in their marriage. And so I'm able to minister to them right where they are. I don't come off preachy. I have a very gentle spirit. And so it reaches them right where they are, and they were like, I knew you were the person that I should be able to talk to based on, because I've been there, and I don't pass judgment. I'm one of those people that believes, you know, if I can help you not repeat some of my same mistakes, I will tell it all.
Right on. Right on. So you were homeless for a while. Yeah, I think that's affecting a lot of people nowadays. And you've also written a book about how to hang on to your home. What is it that you learned about homelessness and retaining a home?
The thing, I was homeless before I even had home ownership. This is when I was single. But as I was meeting my husband, that happened. And so when we came into our marriage, we were like $30,000 in debt together. And so we knew we had to develop a plan to get out of debt. We knew we couldn't file bankruptcy. We knew that we were not going into foreclosure because we both bought debt into the marriage. And so once we got out of debt, our first thing was, well, we need to buy a house in order to, you know, make our money work for us.
Sure.
So it was buying the house. But our whole thing was, we want to buy the house, but we don't want to go back into extraneous debt in order to have a house. So, Veronica, you know how when you first, you go to the loan officer and they qualify you for a house and they tell you, well, here's how much house you can buy. They throw out this astronomical number that's 6 figures long, and they tell you, you can afford that much house. Well, what they're saying is, that's how much debt you can absorb. But it doesn't mean that you should go out and buy a house that's that number. So our goal was to get a house that was quite a bit less than that number, like even in the middle point, because we didn't want to be house poor. We wanted to be able to enjoy a house and put furnishings in the house, but at our own pace, not based on what our neighbors were doing or what our family thought we should do. So what we did was, we did purchase our house, and we did go midway. And what we decided was, we based that household on one income. So that if later on in our marriage I became pregnant, or if my husband became ill and somebody needed to stay at home and we didn't have two incomes, that house could run on one income. And that was one of the best decisions we had ever made, because later on down the road, sure enough, we didn't become pregnant right away. But he did have a change in jobs. And so there was a little bit of a lull between the first job to the second job. So he was able to stay at home for a while. And we ran the house based on my income, because we did it based on his at first, which was the biggest. But there was a time when mine changed, and so mine became the biggest. So when it comes to home ownership, people need to really think about basing that house on one income, not two. And I'm not saying don't have two incomes, because when you have that second income, you can put money away for savings, and now you can have that emergency fund. Now you can save for vacations or even retirement with that second income. And if you're a person that's struggling with debt, well, now you can take that second income and just start paying off stuff big. And
so
people can begin to breathe.
So now, obviously, if you are going to be in a partnership, we're talking about being able to share some decision making around money. So, what kind of tips do you have for people? That can be a kind of a difficult thing, that people have different spending patterns.
Yes, they do. And one of the things, the person who is managing the money, first they have to decide who is going to manage the money. And the person who manages the money still needs to include the person that's not going to be paying the bill, because this way they know how to pay the bills in case something happens to the money manager. Now, the second tip is, we do have different spending patterns. However, if the money manager is able to paint the picture of what the benefit will be as to why they need to save money or why they need to cut back on spending, and the other person can see it, then they will have no problems at all. Because they'll say, oh, I can see how that's going to work out better for us in the big scheme of things. They won't say, oh, you're just telling me not to spend because you just don't want me to spend money. It's not a control issue. There should never be a control issue when it comes to money, whether it's the husband or the wife who's managing the money. Then the third tip is they have to decide what financial goals do they want to set for the overall marriage. What is something that they both would like to see occur? Because, granted, when we come to our relationships, we have our own financial backgrounds, and we have our own financial behavior that we brought into the marriage. And most of the time, people didn't discuss this ahead of time. We take it for granted that we just go, we get to say I do, we love each other, and everything is going to be cool. But as soon as somebody overspends or there's a lack of money, that's when everything goes, you know, it just goes to pot. And so one of the things that happens too, Veronica, that I want to tie in here is when there's financial problems, that's when it affects the bedroom. It affects, you know, intimacy relationships, and affects people wanting to be close and having sex when there's financial problems. Because we don't even like each other now. You have to stay away from me if we're having some financial problems.
Well, okay. So what would you say is, should people wait until they're starting to have problems sexually before and then assume that it's about the money, or when they're starting to have problems with the money, should they get a counselor? I mean, what do you recommend as a kind of a preventive measure, hopefully, to help save?
As a preventive measure, when they first start having financial problems and they see it's getting out of control, because it doesn't start out of control. It starts out where it's a little bit manageable, and people are somewhat in denial when it's manageable. When it gets to that second level and it's gotten more out of control, and now they're starting to get the phone calls and they're getting notices in the mail, which means that they're not handling it. Now they really need to sit back and say, okay, you know what? Let's come clean about what's going on with the finances, and let's seek outside to get some help. Before it gets so far where you're fussing and don't like each other and somebody's sleeping in a different bedroom, or somebody, you know, they come home and then they go back out. Let's start getting help earlier so that there are even words that will not be harshly spoken, because people get really ugly when it comes to money. It changes them, and it shouldn't, but it happens all the time.
Well, give us an example, if you can, about maybe a couple that you've worked with recently and how you were able to help them.
Well, I had a couple recently that, and this was a couple who was engaged, and they hadn't even gotten married yet, but there was, if I remember correctly, the bride was older than the groom, but neither one of them had debt. Yet they had different backgrounds when it comes to money. And they were so used to having their own money and not having to ask permission to buy or spend, you know, these types of things. And so one of the things that they were thinking about was, you know, we want to buy a house, but we don't even have enough credit. They didn't have bad credit, but they didn't even have enough good credit established in order to purchase a home. And so they were looking at, you know, how do we even establish good credit? And then another scenario about that was that one of them worked for the parents. And so when you work for family members, there's a whole other dynamic when you are engaged and preparing to be married, because you have to be able to separate the family from if you're having financial troubles with the fiancé. You don't need to be discussing that at work, because you work with the parents, and they'd be saying, well, you know, maybe he or she's no good. You need to just get rid of them, and we can handle things. Well, no, the parents shouldn't be involved when it comes to that bride or groom's financial situation. The bride and groom need to be turning to each other.
So, obviously, this applies to just about any topic. You don't want a family to get kind of triangulated with you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I suppose money is, I think, kind of it's a form of power in some ways. It can be a form of power. It can accrue power to the person who has it. What do you recommend to couples who, let's say there's a disparity between their income potentials, maybe one partner makes more money than the other?
it is a form of power for some. It's also a means of security. Some people see money as security. When there's a situation where one person is making so much more than the other, the couples need to first start off and sit down and say, how are the bills going to be handled? Are they going to have a joint account, separate account, or are there going to be a combination? Because what I find is if they say, well, we're going to still have separate accounts, we're going to contribute so much. Well, the person who makes more might have to show to contributing more, but not have guilt about, you know, I'm contributing so much more. And the person who's contributing less shouldn't say, well, I can't always contribute as much as you. They have to have that discussion, because that discussion right there is also breaking up relationships, because one person feels bad that they cannot contribute as much. And that's because it wasn't clearly defined from the beginning how it was going to be. Because, Veronica, I tell my couples all the time, those roles can flip-flop. I've seen it happen. It has happened in my own relationship with my husband. There's been times when he made more. There's been times when I made more. And our focus has always been, as long as the bills are paid and we have a very good quality of life, it doesn't matter who makes more. We're working this together. We're in this together. You're not opponents in a marriage. You're on the same team.
Mm-hmm.
That needs to be the focus. We're on the same team. What is it that we want to see happen when it comes to our money and marriage? What type of savings do we want to have? And how? What's the best way for us to accomplish it together? But don't fall so much into, you know, everybody says that marriage is hard work. And it's not hard work. It's people's opinions and mindsets that make things hard. It's work, but it's not hard. You have to decide what you want to see happen.
So, okay, should couples maybe get counseling, financial counseling, before they get married?
Absolutely. I'm a huge proponent of it. And I'm going to tell you why. Because when they're planning the wedding, this is the dry run of what you're going to see throughout your marriage. When you're planning the wedding, you're going to see how are they good at negotiating, because they have to deal with vendors when it comes to the cake, the flowers, the dress. Will they be open about, I went over the budget and spent X amount of dollars when we had an agreement? Is somebody going to say, well, it's my way regardless of what you want? Or will the bride even say, if you tell me no to the fiance, I'll go to dad and mom, and they'll get it for me? All those different dynamics come out during the wedding planning. And if people pay attention, that's exactly what they're going to see throughout their marriage, because you're the same people. This is the first time that you have an opportunity to plan a party for, you know, hundreds of people that you've never done before. And it doesn't matter whose money is paying for it. It's how you handle that money that's painting the picture, whether it's mom or dad's money or the bride or groom is paying for it themselves. They're going to find out what people think about money and how they handle it.
And then what if what you find out in planning your wedding with your beloved, it turns out to be something that you're not real happy about? Maybe you don't like the way they handle money. What's the next thing? What can you do about that?
So there's a couple of different things for that. It depends on what it is that if they're mishandling. Are they not paying the wedding bills, or are they not contributing? Because there are brides who are very upset that their grooms are not contributing when he said he would. And so then you have to discuss, why is he not contributing? And you've shouldered all of the financial bills. That leads you to say, okay, is he even taking care of his own bills that he might be bringing to the marriage? So it might, for some couples, it might say, okay, you know what, let's slow this thing down and not get married so fast, because we need to really see what's going on with the finances. Veronica, there's a lot of people that ignore those red flags because they want to be married, or all their friends are getting married and they don't want to be left out. Well, those things don't really matter, because it costs a lot more to get divorced, and there's a lot more that have gone into the relationship. It doesn't matter how long or small, how long or short it was. There's a lot more ties once you say I do.
Well, that's one of the biggest financial commitments of all.
Right? It is.
When you say I do. It may be all about love going in, but if you do happen to find yourself 50% of America headed for a divorce at some point, it's going to be all about the money.
And that's what everybody says. They say when you walk down the aisle, it's about love. But when you divorce, it's all about the money. And it is, because even these celebrities, I see these celebrities getting divorced, and it turns real nasty. And it's all about the money when they get divorced. But it also happens to the everyday person, because it's about how, and when you say money, at the end of the day, it's not necessarily really and truly they're breaking up because of money. They're breaking up because their value system was not respected.
And how can couples take inventory of their value systems?
What they can do is, first they need to find out if their value system is established on a positive note and not a toxic. And what I mean by toxic is, okay, for example, like, since I didn't grow up knowing how to manage money, my method of managing money was more of a survival skill, because I grew up with a single parent. I didn't grow up with two parents. And so I knew how to survive when it came to money. I know how to make food stretch. I know how to do this. I know how to do that. But once I got married, I had to go more into a management mode, which said, well, we have enough, and you're not surviving. You need to know how to thrive. And so my mindset had to change and say, okay, yes, you can save, but yes, you can also enjoy life. You can have fun and not be worried about, well, now because we went out to this event, I can't pay a bill. You have to really take stock in, okay, are your value system even set up in the right way? And if it's faulty, you can change it. You can say, okay, you know what, that thinking was not necessarily the best for us, and so I want to put that thought out of my mind, and I want to think better about how we can afford, and you make it happen.
Okay. So how do you make it happen?
How do you make it happen is the husband and wife or the bride and groom, you really have to, that communication is key. Talking about it continuously is the key. So you look at the income that's coming in. It's okay, here's the money that we have. Here are the bills that have to be paid. Here's what's left over. What do we want to put away for savings? What do we want to put away towards a house? Because there's a lot of young couples that get married and the first thing they want to do is get a house, but they've never talked about the credit. They've never even shown each other the credit report, and they don't even have money saved for a house. And so they have to really say, okay, what's on that credit report? How do we even start the plans to, you know, begin buying a house? And so you have to have these communications, but you have to have systems in place when it comes to the different areas of life where you want to have a house, where you want to have children, or maybe somebody wants to go back to school. You have to plan and set goals and make sure you put money away in order to do those things.
So this all can be very militant against some people's money style. Some people are very spontaneous. They don't like to save. They don't like to plan ahead. What if two people come together, and this often happens, where one person is a saver and a planner, and the other person is pretty laissez-faire. They just want to spend the money when they got it, and then if they don't have it, that's okay. What would you suggest?
And with that scenario, what I always encourage is that both people have an account that's separate that they can pamper, spend, or whatever, and it doesn't affect the household budget. It's they can put in there the extra money that they have. That's the money where they don't have to get anybody's authorization to spend. It's theirs.
Uh-huh.
Because it won't affect the household budget, so that means that the bills are paid. Because, see, where the conflict comes in is where there's not, you know, a he account or she account that is money I know I have that he don't know. But there is when they have one account and all that money is supposed to go towards the household bills, and the spender saying, you know what, I want to spend it because I made it. And now the money manager can't pay some bill, and that's where the conflict comes in. So I always encourage couples to have at least one account that they have separate, because let's put it on the line. We all have individual credit, regardless of whether you're married or not. When you get married, you don't automatically have joint credit. It's only when you start purchasing things joint that you have something joint, but you still have individualized credit, which means you need to maintain some level of good credit.
So this actually would have been very helpful for my parents. My father was the only breadwinner. My mother was a homemaker. But, she had actually control over the funds and had a background as a bookkeeper, so she was quite adept at budgeting. But my dad felt like, well, he made the money and he wanted to spend it, just exactly what you said.
Yes.
So they had a constant conflict around that. Do you think maybe the situation might have been helped if he had a certain portion of his income was taken off the top and put in another separate fund that he could spend as he chose, while my mother was continuing to disperse the other funds towards bills and expenses?
Absolutely. And the other thing that I find when, you know, he makes all the money and she's controlling the money, but the other thing that I find with that is usually everything is in his name.
Yes.
And there's nothing in her name. And so if something happens to him, where does she start? Even though she was managing the money, where does she start? Because
right.
I've seen that happen over and over again, and so that's why I want both parties in my couples, I want them both to be involved and know how the bills are paid, whether it comes out automatic deduction, whether you still physically put a check in the mail, whether it's you utilizing a credit card. I need both people to know so that if anything happens, the funds, you know, the finances do not go into disarray even more so because the money manager is now out of pocket and can't do anything with the money. And they don't need the stress. They need to recover.
They don't need to stress. They need to recover. Can you explain that?
Well, if they're ill, you know, because I've had people who said, you know what, when I was ill, you know, I was the money manager and I wasn't able to do it. And so then, you know, like the husband would take over the money, but then he wouldn't tell them what was going on when it came to, he didn't know how to handle paying some of the bills, and he got behind because it wasn't his usual role.
Ah.
And so, but he was trying not to stress the wife by saying, well, honey, how do you do this? How do you do that? Because the wife needed to, you know, didn't need the stress of dealing with the finances. Because usually the money manager does carry the weight of the world when it comes to the finances within the relationship, whether it's the male or the female. Whoever it is, they carry the weight of the world. And they're dealing with things that they're not sharing with that other person because they think they can do it all. But they're stressing, but they're getting it done until something happens like this, when the economy tanked. When the economy tanked, that's when husbands and wives found out just what was going on with the finances. They were forced to talk about money.
Mm.
They weren't talking about it
before. This is affecting a lot of people now,
a tremendous
number of people. Do you know whether or not the divorce rate has gone up since? I think it has. I know the domestic violence rate has certainly gone up since the economy tanked.
Yeah, I believe it has, and it continues to go up because what I see when I watch the news and these couples, and let's bring in the domestic violence because you're so right about that. What happens is they're screaming for help, but nobody's listening to them. You know, when they're going to the loan officer saying, I can't pay my house note if you can just give me a few months. And they're not listening to them. They're turning a deaf ear to them. Or the husband is saying to the wife, my job, the hours got cut, and I'm trying to figure out how to make it. And I've called some people, but nobody's able to help me. And that's when people get violent.
Right.
They've been so fed up that nobody's listening to them, and now they're just lashing out at everybody in their immediate circle. You know, wives, children, coworkers, bosses, they're lashing out. And I always get so sad when I find out that a spouse, male or female, has been killed and they had a restraining order. Because I believe a restraining order just sets people off even more. It doesn't stop them. It makes them come after the person even more.
It often does, yes. People feel like they have lost control and they're trying to
they
regain
really do.
It.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so when the economy tanked, people were really forced to talk about what is going on with the money. Why didn't you tell me? And some of them don't like the things that they're hearing. But the other side of that is they don't even have enough money to get divorced and even separate. They can't afford it. So they're staying in the house together. They don't like each other. They don't love each other. But they don't have any money to get divorced and going about their business.
So that is the War of the Roses, isn't it? An old,
it really is.
Michael Douglas film.
Yes.
Yes. Where he and his wife split the house right down the middle.
Right down the middle. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yes, and had a really contentious divorce in process.
Yes. And you know what I often wonder, though? I said, okay, so since they don't have the money to get divorced, what are the chances that now that they're forced to talk about money, what are the chances that they could actually save that marriage? Because now they know how ugly it is. They could work it out. But
right.
they have to be willing.
Yes.
You know, it really depends. They have to be willing. And we know that divorce brings up some ugly things. Money does, too. When people mismanage it, it brings out an ugly side of people. And the thing that I'm always wondering is, were the words too harsh? Because you can't take those words back once they come out that mouth. You cannot take them back.
Yeah.
And money does make people emotional. It really does. And so...
Well, don't you think that money does kind of affect the survival? I think for a lot of people it feels like their survival is threatened. It's like a basic need.
Yes, it does. And the difference is, and I always tell people is, okay, money in itself, if you took some money out your wallet right now and put it down on the table, it can't do anything by itself. But it's how you handle it and how you manage it. And so if you think money is survival, then make it work for you instead of not learning how to manage money and it's working against you when you don't know how to manage it. Because if you don't know how to pay your bills on time, and if you're not really watching your bank accounts and calling and verifying that the things that are coming out you did buy, or if you're not reading your credit report and making sure that every entry on there does belong to you, then you're going to end up in a vicious cycle where you're not managing and you're being controlled by your money instead of you controlling your money. And it happens all the time. The money situations that we end up in is by the choices that we made. I know that my homelessness happened because of the choices that I made, mismanaging money, and I chose not to talk to somebody because I was shamed. I had a lot of pride.
So how do people break through that shame? It's just, after all, the shame-free zone, I think that's a really pertinent topic about this issue. Obviously, it would seem like finding other people, and you seem like a prime candidate here, since you're willing to admit that you were homeless, but what's your recommendation for people who are so bowed with financial shame that they don't feel like they can reach out to anybody?
The thing with that is you have to get so sick and tired of being sick and tired and living in lack and not being able to enjoy life.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get to that point, you shame goes right out the window. You're like, you know what, I am so sick of this. I am tired of people calling me in the morning, waking me up with collector calls. I'm tired of going to bed at night, and that's the last call I have. Now I can't even sleep at night because I'm stressing and wondering how I'm going to pay the bill. My health has been affected. My work performance has been affected. You have to get that tired of being in debt and struggling. The shame will go right on out that window, because at that point and at that level, you will reach out because you know that you can't do it within yourself. You know that you have to get outside help so that the cycle does not continue. Because there's nothing like a creditor waking you up in the morning, and they're not the nicest people in the world. They're not supposed to be, though. But they call you and they let you know that you can't pay a bill. You already know that. They're not telling you something that you don't know. But it just tends to ruin your day when you start out like that.
I think that's very funny. They're not telling you anything you don't know, but they sure do find some creative ways to tell you what you already know.
Oh yeah, they got some real creative ways on how to say it now, and they start out so nice. They will start out saying, "Well, you know, Miss Wagner, I'm so and so and so," and you'd be like, "Okay, you know," but it's not the call that you just want to wake you up in the morning. And they can call as much as they want to, until you tell them no. But usually when people are struggling with finances, they don't know their creditor rights, and so they don't know what they can tell the creditor to stop doing.
Well, I think that is the prime directive of all creditors or collection agencies, which is to evoke as much shame as possible.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They try to make you feel so bad about yourself. And
yes.
My thing is, you know what? You do not have to feel bad about yourself, because life does happen and we make bad choices. But now we need to take control and show them that we are in control of our money and we can clean up this situation. Because I'll tell you something. I had a creditor that had contacted me way back when I was in all that mess. And, you know, he wanted to set up a payment plan, and I was in a place where I could do it this time around. And so when I got down to, like, my next to last payment, he said, "Well, Ms. Wagner, if you ever need a reference and you want to rebuild your credit, you can have them call me." Veronica, I almost fell off my chair Because, you know, they never say nothing like that.
Yes.
But
yes.
His thing was, you did exactly what you told me you were going to do, and I'm proud of you. I will help you reestablish your credit. And I was like, okay, send me your name and number, because I was writing down. I said, oh, no, I'm not going to ever forget that. But that's the thing, you know, society has us so scared that you can't talk to them. Well, you can if you get them on the phone and really plead your case and explain what happened. They will work with you.
Yes, well, years and years ago, actually, when I got out of college, I was an honor student, and they gave me all kinds of credit cards, and I maxed them all out, and I wasn't able to make the monthly minimums, and I was just accruing horrible interest charges. So I did that. I used that pyramid system, you know, where you pay back the minimums on all the credit cards, and then as you pay off a credit card, you roll that minimum payment over to the next smallest card, you know, the next biggest card, actually, and just keep paying them off like that. It worked pretty well, and yes, people, you know, are willing to work with you usually. It's not totally advantageous to write you off, although I think with homes now, there's kind of a mixed bag out there. There's this whole, you know, program to keep people in their homes. Mm-hmm. And then there also seems to be some economic incentives for the banks to foreclose. What's your take on this, since you wrote a book about how to stay in your home?
You know, the first thing that happened that I was finding out when it came to the homes, and, you know, before people were really having trouble with their home and not being able to afford it, they were contacting their bank. They really were, and they were saying, listen, I know some things are going on at my job, and I'm not going to be able to make a payment. Can you work with me now as I'm going into this process? And the banks would tell them, no, because you're not behind. You're not behind. You're current on your loan. You've always been current. So people had to literally stop paying their mortgage in order to get help. And it wasn't like skip one payment, skip two payments. They had to skip, you know, quite a few payments in order to get some help when it came to the mortgage company. And there are some people who still haven't gotten help, and it's been years when they fell into this situation. And so one of the things that I always try to tell people is, listen, if you have a talent or gift, or you are very, you know, if you can, you know, bake something, or you can make things that people will buy, you need to create your own bailout system, because these people have been waiting for 2 years, and then their houses are getting foreclosed on.
Right.
The banks have the incentive, but the banks aren't helping them because it's so much paperwork, and there's certain things that they have to do. I saw a story here on the news where one lady had sent it in several times, and they kept turning her down, and somehow her paperwork even got lost one time. She had sent in everything they needed, and she was getting foreclosed on. But the news station stepped in, and thank goodness they saved her, but it was the fault of the lender. It wasn't even her fault. And so I think that they have a lot of people who are working in these mortgage industries that don't even know what's going on. They're taking calls, but they're not giving out, you know, valid information. But they don't realize people's lives are at stake. They're losing the American dream.
Yes, yes, I actually heard that Ohio, certain cities in Ohio, are bulldozing homes because if they leave them standing after they've been abandoned, and they're being abandoned by the banks. The banks are foreclosing on the poor people and evicting them. Then the homes are vacant, and they're vandalized and mostly salvaged. People go in and take all the, you know, light fixtures and copper wiring and everything they can possibly get their hands on out of the house, and it's just gutted and standing there as an eyesore. And so the people who are left in their homes want those houses taken out. Otherwise, it's going to degrade the property values and, you know, basically turn their neighborhood into some kind of a ghetto. And so it's really, really sad to think about all the people who are now homeless and the homes that are being, you know, destroyed.
Yes. And I've seen that happen where people will destroy the home when they're left. But in one instance where I saw that was, it wasn't that the home was, it was left, but it was before they were getting out of the house. They knew that they were going to be, you know, thrown out, and they just destroyed it. They, you know, people just destroyed the house. And it's like, what's the purpose of that? because I'm, you know, I'm like, you know what, whatever you do does come back to you. That whole karma thing does happen. It happens. You treat people the way you want to be treated in personal and in business.
Yes, yes.
It happens.
Yeah, so banks are no exception to that.
No, they're not, because, you know, this is what I think about. When I think about the banks and I think about the creditors calling and these types of things, it's like, you need to think about that person on the other end, because that could very well be you one day, and you should treat that person and listen to what they have to say. Don't think that they're a bad person. Life happens and jobs happen. Jobs come and go. People don't plan for that is what usually happens. They were counting on, you know, being at a job 20 and 30 years don't even exist anymore. There's no loyalty to employees anymore like it used to be when I was so much younger. But that doesn't happen in these days. And so people can't bank on, oh, I can be at this job 20 years and retire. Well, no, because if new management comes in and they decide they want to shake everything up, you know, the whole old crew goes out and they bring in their own people.
That's so true. Once again, listeners, we are listening to Dr. Taffy Wagner. She's a certified educator in personal finances, money, and marriage. And she's also an ordained minister. And tonight she is gifting us with a 30-minute no-cost counseling session to our first caller. So if that's you, give us a buzz right now, toll-free in both the United States and Canada. That number is 888-627-6008. Once again, 888-627-6008. I'm wondering what sort of problems happen right after people say, I do. So I'm thinking, like, you know, there's some, oftentimes one type of relationship that people have when they're engaged. Then there's an entirely different relationship that tends to come up once they're married. And I wonder how that affects the finances in your experience.
How it affects the finances. Okay, so one type of relationship is we knew that there were money issues, we didn't address them, and now after we say I do, we can't handle it. We want to call everything off. Mm. I've gotten that email 6 days after the wedding. And my thing is always this, okay, that didn't start 6 days after the wedding. That was always there, and you chose not to address it. And I like to tell my couples, it takes a certain level of maturity to handle money in marriage, because money is no joke. It's nothing to be played with when it comes to money being security to a person, planning their future, planning for parenting, home ownership, and all these different things. Then the other side of it that I've seen is, they haven't discussed, now they didn't necessarily know that there was any baggage coming in when it came to finances, but now they're trying to really figure out, okay, well, he has these, you know, this debt and I have this debt. How do we bring it together? How do we work things out? And so there's not really any hard feelings there, but they're saying, how do we start now that we've already gotten married? How do we clean this up and prepare to move forward?
Hmm. Yeah,
so I kind of like that, because at least they are going, they want to address it. I don't like that they didn't address it before they got married, but at least they're willing to say, okay, let's really sit down and look at what's going on. And I have to tell you, I did have one couple that had been married for about 2 years, and the young lady had contacted me, and she said, oh, my marriage is about to end, because she was the secret shopper. Yeah, the secret shopping husband didn't know. But it got so bad that he found out, and he was ready to call it off. He was ready to pull the plug, because she was spending so bad, it came out to the light. And that's the other thing. It's like, you know what? Don't think that you can secretly spend in a marriage and the other person's never going to find out. They will always find out. You might as well be up front and say, honey, you know, here's the thing that I want to do. Go ahead and spend. Or, like I talked about earlier, have that account that's just yours where you can spend and you don't have to say to that person, here's the money that I spent.
You know, women try to do that sometimes with their clothes, don't they? They'll buy new, put it in the back of the closet.
Yeah.
Then when they bring it out, they let it sit in the closet for a few months. Then when they bring it out and wear it for the first time, and he says, is that something new? You can say, this thing, I've had it forever.
Yes. Absolutely. Well, I got to tell you something about that. My husband's the shopper in our relationship, and his thing is gadgets. And I would go in the cabinet, and I'd be like, where did them dishes come from? And he's like, oh, I bought that quite a while ago. And I was just like, oh, my goodness, stop, you know. So, but you have to get to where if there's a certain level of, you know, you always have to have trust in a relationship. But you know that they're not going to do anything that would harm the relationship. And that's where you have to be able to be when it comes to the shopper and that level of spending. You have to know that they're not going to do something overboard to throw the finances into a tizzy, that they do have their own account and it's okay.
Mm-hmm. And if they don't, then what?
And if they don't, then you need to sit down and address and say, okay, why did you feel that you needed to spend a certain amount of dollars without even having a discussion first when we had an agreement? Because if you have an agreement that it's going to be a certain way, then usually the person's not going to step over that. And they'll respect that and say, okay, I know that she wouldn't like it if I did this, or he wouldn't like it if I did that. So let's go talk with them and say, okay, here's something that I would like to get. And discuss whether it's a need or a want. I like to tell people, give it a 72-hour hold. Don't buy it. You can wait for 72 hours. And if after 72 hours you still want it, and as long as it's still there and it won't affect the household budget, then go ahead and get it. But if after 72 hours you done moved on to something else, then you know it wasn't even necessary to have.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, it requires a lot of communication skills.
It seems to me really if couples
are going to be able to talk about their money issues.
Veronica, let me throw this in there. If you can talk about the money, I'm telling you, the intimacy level and the relationship skyrockets. Because there's no stress now.
Mm-hmm.
There's no stress. There's no fighting. People can pamper each other at will. You don't have to wait for nobody's special holiday. Just because I got up today and felt great, I'm going to go out and buy some balloons or some roses or whatever and give them to my spouse. It's a great thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what about the weddings? Do you advise couples who are thinking about getting married to spend a tremendous amount of money on the wedding or the honeymoon? I know for me, my husband and I opted for a very inexpensive and informal wedding, and then we spent a lot of money on our honeymoon, which for us meant that, you know, we were going to have a lot more fun. A wedding's just one day. Our honeymoon was a whole week.
Right. Well, what I tell people is this. Okay, so for the person for the couple who can afford, you know, if they want the big elaborate wedding and nobody has to go into debt for it, then fine, you do that if that's what you want to do. But for the couple who cannot afford the big elaborate wedding, be very realistic in your finances and make sure you create the wedding of your dreams, not the wedding of society's dreams, not the wedding of so-and-so's dream that's on all these wedding forms that you belong to, but create the wedding that is your dream so that you can afford it, look back on the day and say, oh, it was a great day, and we did not go into debt, and we could still go into our marriage liking each other and loving each other and go on the honeymoon and come back and say, wow, we did a great thing, and enjoy looking back on that day. Because when they don't do it that way, the first thing they do when they come back from the honeymoon is point fingers to say, you know what, we didn't need 500 people at the wedding, or we didn't need all those save the dates, or we didn't need this, and we could have, you know, done without those things. Because now they're looking at the wedding bills, and they're mad. They're not happy at all. So they're not even nurturing that relationship.
Yes. There's the popular reality TV show called Bridezilla.
Yeah.
Or something like that. I don't watch
right.
it much. But,
me either, but I know of it.
Yes, and it's all about these brides who must have the wedding exactly the way they want it or else they're going to throw a fit. It's really an atrocious advertisement for the state of marriage, I think.
Yes.
And I think a lot of women do kind of get caught up in the wedding being like some special debut party or something, some coming out parties. It's all about her.
It is.
Yeah, what
and
do you think
right.
about that?
I think they're sending the wrong message, because I tell my brides, and that's why I even wrote the book for both of them, because I said, you know what? He has a say-so in this. It's about him, too. Do not make him think he don't have a voice. in the wedding planning. Because if you set that tone right now during your engagement, he's going to think that he don't have a voice throughout that marriage. And that's not the way it needs to be. And I did see Bridezilla a couple of times, and I would think to myself, he needs to run. If you're this over the top right now and it hasn't even happened, he needs to run.
Yes.
Because it would just be a virtual nightmare. The way that they're demanding that, you know, so-and-so has to lose so much weight, the wedding party. One day I was like, are you kidding me? You want these people to lose a certain amount of weight or they can't be in your wedding party? I'd be like, I'll walk out.
Yeah.
How do you get a dictator try to control somebody like
right.
that?
Right.
No.
Mm-mm. Yeah. I'll tell you, I attended my stepson's wedding in Maui in 2007, and I've never seen so much drama.
There
was,
yeah.
you know, the bride was crying because of something her mother said. There was one of the best men or groomsmen, I don't know exactly what his role was refusing to walk down the aisle because he didn't want to walk with the particular girl he'd been assigned to walk with.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
embarrassing things were said during the toast.
It
was actually hilarious. I just kind of sat back and watched it. It was kind of its own funny reality TV show, funny in a kind of a tragic comic way.
Right.
But it just seems like they spent way too much money, and for what? What's amazing, you know, oftentimes is that people waste all this money on the wedding day and then spend those first few years of marriage homeless or poor or in debt. And what a horrible way to start your relationship.
It is. And I firmly believe those first 2 years, you need to spend that whole time nurturing that relationship. Because you will, if you have not planned for money issues to come up and know how to handle them, you will get so many in that first year, it will tear that marriage up. I mean, I can literally remember my husband's car breaking down. Now, we already had debt, Veronica. And then his car was breaking down, and we didn't have the money to pay the car. You know, these types of things. But luckily, the place that he works at will take out a certain amount every pay period so you can get your car fixed. I was like, oh, God, thank you. Because we were like, he needs a car. I can't do anything. He needs his car.
Yeah.
And so, but we were, you know, the car was happening, and all these other different financial issues were coming up. And if we had not talked about here's how we're going to handle things and we didn't have good problem-solving skills, it would have tore that marriage up, and we're going to be celebrating 16 years next month.
16 years? Well, congratulations.
Yes. You know, and so I'm talking about things we have lived. You know, it's like I know this thing like the back of my hand.
I hear you do. And, you know, believe it or not, we've got just a few more minutes here. Time has just flown. It's a delight speaking with you. And I would love it if you would tell our listeners more about your website, your books, how they can find you, or maybe your columns, whatever you want to share.
Okay, so the website is Bride Groom Money Talk FAQ, named afterthebook.com. And on that site, you can actually download the first chapter for free. Also, what I'm doing is books that I bought from my website, the first 150 copies that I bought from my site during this virtual book tour, which goes this month and all the way through February, they will actually get one of the characters that's on the cover of this book. I actually created a dollar bill bride and a dollar bill groom. So they'll get one of those characters, not both, when they buy a copy of this book from my website.
Really cute, by the way.
Oh, my goodness. I tell you, I always try to think about, you know, what can I make my cover? I need something to stand out. And I had created a cover, and I didn't like it. And I told my husband, I said, I don't even like the cover, because he usually does my covers. But this time I wanted to do it myself. And one night after everybody went to bed, I was like, you know what? I'm going to make these what people. And when he woke up the next morning, he was like, oh, babe, that's it. That is so nice.
It is. It's a really, really cute cover. They can also find you on Facebook, yes?
Yes, on Facebook, my page is Bride Groom Money Talk, and so they can like our page, and I'm always putting information up there. I have a Twitter account that's Bride Groom Money. I'll be blogging for Black Bride starting later this month, But the other site is called adviceandinfo.com, and there's I talk about love and money on adviceandinfo.com, and it's up there already.
Okay.
So that's how they can find me. I also do provide premarital financial counseling because I believe in equipping them up front.
Absolutely. Now, how can they contact you for the premarital financial counseling?
Also on Bridegroom Money Talk FAQ site. It's on that site as well.
Okay.
But if they want to just read information on money and marriage, they can go to brideandgroommoneytalk.com, which is a blog where I talk about celebrity weddings, issues around money. And if they've been married already for a long time and need help, I got another site that's called Money Talk Matters.
Okay.
And I deal with couples who've been married for quite a while, some women who've been widowed or single parents, those types of things. I from the whole gamut, I'll teach it all.
Well, thank you so much for a very fascinating and timely conversation. And to my listeners, I want you to know that next week I'm going to be interviewing Chief Philip Scott. We're going to be talking about indigenous sacred sexuality, specifically Native American traditions around sexuality and around spirituality. So I think this is a great way to kick off 2012, as was tonight's show with Dr. Taffy Wagner. So be sure to visit our archives if you want to download your copy of this show with Dr. Wagner, and tune in next Monday at 9 p.m. Pacific time. See you then.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak mutus kabar berita?